Hi, welcome to Listen, a podcast about guitars and guitarists. Today we are very happy to have a true legend of jazz fusion in our show. Please welcome the one and only Mr. Frank Gambale. Frank, thank you for having the time to sit in with us. We really appreciate it.
So, how come Barcelona?
Well, you know, I've been around the world about 100 times, so, you know, there's lots of beautiful places in the world.
Yeah.
I've always loved the work of Antoni Gaudi and Dali and, you know, this area, there's something special, you know. So I wanted to be close to all that beautiful art. And Barcelona is one of the most beautiful cities I've ever seen. And, you know, the weather, and I always wanted to be close to Mediterranean and stuff like that. It's beautiful here. I love it. I love it. I'm very happy here.
Yeah. Mm. And the food's not bad either.
It's not bad. It's just nice, you know. It's a beautiful part of the world, so I'm happy here.
Yeah.
And it's very central to all of Europe, you know. I can be in Morocco in 2 hours. I can be in London in 2 hours. I can be in Rome. You know, it's all very, very close to a lot of great stuff. So,
yeah. Do you think that the fusion scene or jazz scene in Europe is like more critical for you than the States, so that living in Europe is like convenient in terms of touring?
Well, I like that there's the diversity of cultures so close, you know. You know, France will never be Italy, and Italy will never be France, and, you know, you can be so close to all these different cultures very quickly.
Yeah.
You know, you can fly 6 hours in America, and you're still in America, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the audiences are great in America. I don't, you know, I think the audiences are fantastic for jazz in America. So, yeah, look, it's not a question of the type of people or anything. It's just, you know, I lived in America in L.A. for 40 years, and I just wanted to change. Plus, yeah. I have a 12-year-old daughter. I wanted to expose her more. She's traveled a little bit with us, but me and my wife, but I wanted her to be bilingual, and I wanted her to have a richer cultural experience. That's all. So, yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
So, how about touring nowadays? Obviously, the pandemic is starting to get pass by, and we're getting back to normal, hopefully. So,
well,
how about?
I really hope so.
Yeah. So, the tour you're about to have now.
Yeah.
Can you tell something about it?
Well, you know, I'm just incredibly excited to play, you know, because I've played one concert in 2 years. So do you still have my picture? I'm not sure if you still have my Skype. For some reason the picture seems to have, oh, I see what's happening. Yeah. Yeah, I'm very excited to play. You know, it's been way too long. I mean, the COVID thing has been devastating to our industry, our music industry, and the entertainment industry in general. And I don't want people to get too used to just going, oh, well, here's a concert in my bedroom. You know, I don't want that.
Yeah.
I think there's nothing like the live experience. Seeing someone actually performing before your eyes, and that's a rich human experience that I never want to lose that. You know, internet is very tempting because you can reach so many people so easily, whereas, you know, in a club or in a small theater or a big theater even, you know, the number of people is limited. But that's, you know, that's important too. I think, you know, I like to do it all. I of course, am in touch with all my social media, and those kind of outlets are important. But I also like to get in front of real people, you know, looking at a screen, and it's so virtual. And now I still love the human contact, so I'm really excited. The tour, the band is amazing. Gergo Berlai, I don't know if you know him on drums. He's incredible.
Yeah.
This will be my first tour with him. Hadrian mm-hmm. Farod is also an outstanding, excellent musician and bass player. And George Witte, who spent many years with the Brecker Brothers. And, you know, it's as good a group as I can assemble. It's a very exciting band. So it's going to be fireworks, really. We're all so excited. It's just going to be a great, great energy coming off the stage.
Yeah. So what's the process when you pick up a band like this? Why do you choose certain players to be in your touring band? Or when you ask them if they want to come out, what's the process? What do you think?
Well, you know, I love to use young players and new players wherever I can. Like, I've never worked with Gergo live before. He came highly recommended to me through Hadrian. You know, because I think a bass player and drummer really need to be on the same page. And it's good if they know each other, and it's good if they're friends, you know, because then you know that the rhythm section is going to be strong and gelling and doing what it does best, you know, at its best. I watched a few videos with Gergo, and I went, holy moly, you know. And what's convenient, actually, is that he lives in Barcelona, actually.
Oh, yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, he does. He shares his time between L.A. and Barcelona. But, you know, he hasn't been in L.A. much because L.A., you know, has some cultural problems, you know, with homelessness. And, you know, there's 70,000 homeless people on the street in L.A. That's incredible to me. It was getting so bad, the traffic and the homelessness, it was time to go. I don't know what's happening there in America. You know, we've left a lot of great friends behind, and a great many of them have moved away from LA too.
Yeah.
It just didn't feel safe. You know, when COVID started, everybody was lining up to buy guns. There were lines like a rock concert, you know, just at front of gun shops, you know.
Yeah.
I found that rather disturbing. You know, there's too many guns. I just I'm not a gun advocate. I don't own one. I don't want one. I don't even like to see them.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, it was time to go. Anyway, so you were asking about the musicians. You know, Gergo is new to me. Hadrian I've worked with before, and I like to have him whenever he's available, you know. Sometimes it's a question of availability too.
Yeah.
I choose the guys I choose that have a lot of can play all different styles, because my show – this particular show, I'm going to be playing a lot of different kinds of music, you know. It's hard to pigeonhole me because I like a lot of different things. I like to play my jazz guitar, like, you know, George Benson style. Mm-hmm. I love to play the fusion rock thing and blast away doing that. And I like to play acoustic guitar. I have I'll be playing my double neck on this tour as well. I've invented a new tuning called Gambale tuning, for want of a better name. And so I'm going to feature a lot of different stuff. I'm going to sing also. You know, I've sung a lot in the past. My last two records are all vocal tunes. You know, it's a variety of things. So musicians need to have a broad experience. So that's really something I look for, especially in bass players and drummers, because, you know, the drummers need to be able to play everything from a samba to a funk, to a rock fusion, to, you know, straight ahead swinging, you know. So that requires a lot of experience and a lot of a broad experience in different styles. Same with bass players, you know. It's and all the musicians, really, they all need to play different styles. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, George, I've worked with also in L.A. We played in the clubs quite a bit right before I left LA. So for the last 6 months or so, I was playing with George, and he's an incredible musician and an incredible accompanist. It's really hard to find a keyboard player that's happy to just be supportive and not, you know, I don't like too much confrontation, you know. Mm-hmm. When it's the drummer's solo, then it's all support for drum. You know, we're all there lifting them up and making them sound the best they can. And when it's the bass solo, everybody comes down and you support. You don't get in the way of the soloist.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people can tend to overplay, especially drummers, you know. When it's time to play groove, I don't want the groove to break ever. I want it to be solid. I want it to be straight. And when it's, you know, when it's something more fusion, of course, then there's more interaction. But groove tunes need to groove. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be taken out of my trance-like state when I'm playing. I like to be focused, and I don't need something going, what was that? Or, you know, playing a stupid beat that's going to break the groove, and it's just...
I was just about to ask that. It's like a balancing act when you think of the rhythm section, that they know how to interact with each other musically, and that's what you just explained. So
cool. Yeah, some drummers, it really depends, you know. Some drummers can play the wildest stuff, but the pulse is always clear, and others just don't have that and can really feel like it's not quite right, you know, and it can, you know, stump the band. I don't want the band to be going, where's one all the time, you know. It's mm-hmm. I want to know where the one is without too much headache, you know. Especially as I get older, you know, I just I want what I want, and I want to present a good show, and I want people to groove at my shows. I want people to enjoy the music and be involved, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So have you thought about working with European musicians in the future, now when you're living in Barcelona?
Well, of course. Gergo is from Hungary. Hadrian's from France. mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely. The only one show I did play in my COVID period was, I think, back in August. I played a beautiful festival in a town in France called Hendaye, near the Spanish border, and it was all French guys. That was a fantastic band. So, yeah, of course, I definitely want to tap the Euro talent when I'm in Europe. You know, if I'm touring in the States, I'll probably use a US-based band because it just makes sense.
So let's talk about your playing style and technique for a bit.
Sure.
Can you talk about the beginnings of your style, how it started to evolve, and how you realized that this is my sound, this is what I want to do?
Well, when I was about, I started playing very young, at about 7, I think, was when I started, because my 2 older brothers were also playing. They were in their early teens, and so I just wanted to be like them at first. I just wanted to play, you know. And it was Hendrix and Beatles and the rich music of the late 60s. That's when I was learning, and I was going, wow, all this cool music. And so I guess my first 7 years of my playing, I was in blues. You know, I was playing blues and pentatonic stuff that, is a beautiful foundation, to learn expression on the instrument, you know, how to make the guitar sing and talk, you know, and scream and all that other stuff. And then I don't know, something happened. I just started to explore other kinds of music, because after about 6 or 7 or 8 years of playing straight blues, I thought, I think I got this, you know. I want to move on to some other harmony and advance as a musician and seek out other things. And so I started to listen to other groups like Steely Dan, and I was listening to Jean-Luc Ponty's music, those earlier fusion records, and of course Return to Forever and Chick Corea blew my head off. So I started going into that area, and I also started to listen more to keyboard and saxophone, Mike Brecker. Mm-hmm. And so I started to transcribe their solos a lot more. Mm-hmm. That was, it forced me to find technique to be able to play some of the lines that Chick Corea was playing, It seemed nearly impossible on the guitar to play some of those, especially the arpeggios and the sorry, my phone sounds like a trumpet. I'd never heard that notification before. So I started to listen to keyboards and sax and transcribe this stuff on the guitar. And the thing is, when you do that, when I was listening to guitar, for example, a blues player, I could tell what fret and what string it was, I could, because I know the guitar, I understood the guitar. So there was no mystery there. I could just transcribe it and use my ear to go, oh, it's probably the B string being bent, at this A minor pentatonic position or whatever. But when I was transcribing saxophone and guitar, there was no precedent. There was no preset place on the instrument to play it. Mm. So it made me start to think in a new way, because there were certain phrases I couldn't play. And I went, okay, so I have to find a way to play this up to speed. And so the sweep just became the method, because some saxophone phrases sound kind of like sweeps. That kind of thing. It just lends itself to the sweep technique on the guitar.
Yeah.
And, the sweep thing, it was there like this. There was this much sweep going on in the world at that time. And so I discovered certain phrases that made logical sense. To go across three strings in a single stroke just made more sense than doing an alternate across. It just didn't make sense to do that. So the logic prevailed, and I started to evolve it, and I took it to the moon. Nobody did what I did on with the sweep picking technique when I did it. It was absolutely new. And so when I moved to the States in 82, I was 22 years old in LA, and I went to GIT music school, and, people were going, what the hell are you doing? When it was new, you can imagine when sweep picking was new, nobody had seen it to this degree ever before. I call it Gambale sweep picking now, because people say, oh, well, sweeping existed, Charlie Christian went, but did he go all over the, no, he didn't. Nobody did. And so people couldn't go, where are all the notes coming from? It just looked like even when I looked at video of myself doing it, I just went, it doesn't compute. There seems to be too many notes and not enough movement. It's incredibly efficient, and it keeps evolving. I keep finding new stuff. Oh, my phone. Sorry, I'll turn it off. So it just keeps evolving. I just did a new video course for my online school, frankabaliguitarschool.com. I brought forward... I did my first book when I was a student at GIT, because people kept asking me, I was trying to practice, and people kept saying, can you show me how to do that? Can you show me? So I wrote, The Fundamentals, which became my speed picking book, which was published in 19... Now it's coming through on my computer. You know, they kept bugging me, so I said, I'm going to write all this stuff, and I wrote a bunch of licks, and it became my book, and I said, here, I gave them photocopies for free. Here, this is what I – let me practice. And then in 86, I did the video Monster Licks and Speed Picking, and I wanted to share it because I think it's an incredibly liberating technique for the instrument. And, you know, although it doesn't cure every technical issue, it does make the guitar liberating, and it gets you beyond the instrument so that you can fly. You know, the technique guitar is a hard instrument to master to the point where you can play anything you want, and it takes many years. And I think the sweep picking, if I had started from the beginning with this method, it would have been incredibly liberating back then. Because the people, when you watch students pick, they want to do that in a natural – they do it naturally because it makes sense. When you're stuck with alternate all the time, it doesn't – it's not always the most logical way to pick. So with my new course, you know, because I did the original stuff back in the 80s, there was so much more that I had developed over the last 30 years that I had to do a new course that includes all the fundamental stuff plus all the new developments in the technique.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how long did it approximately take you to come up with the sweep picking thing, if you'll try to remember it? Are we talking about thousands of hours, or?
Oh, I don't know. Believe me, when I was when I got finished with high school, I was living with my parents. I was 17. That period really was from 17 until 22, when I moved to America to study more. I literally was waking up and going to sleep with the guitar in my hand. I didn't have a job, but my parents were very supportive. And I was literally doing 12-hour days music or more for years. And I also was like that for the first few years in America, too, until I was about 25. The first 3 years, I had nothing to think about but guitar. I had, you know, really saved up everything I could before I left Australia so that I was able to support myself with a little help from my parents for several years there before I got established, you know.
Yeah.
But I literally did 12 hour days were pretty average, you know, on guitar. And that's what it takes sometimes. You know, I always said to myself as a young man, I always went, you know, who wants to grow up to be medium or average? I don't want to grow up to be average. I'd rather be complete shit at something or as best and brilliant at something if I can. If that's my aims, there's no in between. You know, that's Frank. He's really ordinary. You know, who wants to be that? Yeah. I don't want to be that. So I had high aims for my my musical life. You know, I really wanted to be the best I could be, and so I put the time in. You know, and I put the time in even when I was a kid. When I was 7 years old, you know, I was listening to Hendrix and copying Hendrix stuff. You know, I even played my first pop festival. My brothers pushed me onto a stage at a pop festival and said, "Hey, let this kid play a blues with you." You know, I was 9. I sat on the edge of the stage with my legs hanging over. I was and my guitar on. And I played for 1,000 people that all were you know, applauding. And that effect on a kid, you know, were, wow, this is great. I want to do this. So, yeah, look, I was inspired from a young age that and my life was pretty much destined to be a guitar player, and there was nothing else, you know.
Mm-hmm. Has there been any moments of doubt when you doubted yourself that is this going to work out?
Well, you know, the thing about being a musician in general is there's no safety net. It's not people often think that, oh, look, I work for Google. My life, my job is guaranteed for life, you know. Not necessarily. Companies, big companies, lay off workers thousands at a time. Sorry, our profits are down. We're canceling 5,000 jobs. Boom. And so much for your, considering that it's a perfect job and there's, you know, there's security in a big company, you know. But the difference is, as musicians, I've never had a real job. This is hilarious, really. I've never had an insurance job or worked, you know, for a company. Never, ever. I used to work in music shops when I was younger because I would sell guitars and, you know, be close to the things that I loved. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you learn to be resourceful. You learn to be creative inside. Look, it's being a musician is not simply playing the instrument. It's also being, you got to be smart as a businessman too. You got to be, there's the business side of it. You know, there's the music business and then there's the art. And the two worlds are completely different. And both need to be managed if you want to have a successful career. There's no guarantees. You have to get up in the morning. You have to hustle. You have to find work. You have to create your contacts, you know. And when I first got to L.A., one of the things I did, which I think is really important, is that you have to take anything. Take any and all jobs because you have to realize that, you know, if you play on a $50 gig in L.A., and it might be a wedding or something, you know, something you have to do because you need the money, but you never know who you're going to meet. This is the thing, you know, the bass player could be working for, Barry Manilow or any famous artist you care to name. You don't know because they're doing a gig too in between. And when they hear you play and they go, wow, man, you're really good, they'll remember and they may recommend you for something else, you know, or you keep the contacts that you meet. Even, you know, everyone, you never know who you're going to meet in the music industry, you know. And so when you do your best on the gig, no matter what the gig is and your attitude is good, you know, the work comes to you, basically. Everybody that has a good attitude and shows up and does the gig with a smile, you know, even if it's a small gig that seems insignificant, it can turn into other things. So in L.A., I took everything. I was sometimes in five or six bands at once. Wherever possible, I would take gigs and meet people. It's a people business, you know. In fact, most businesses are, no matter what industry you're in. And you've got to deliver. You do the job. You get there on time. You take regular showers. Always helps. You have good sounding gear. You know, good equipment. You work on your tone. Because we, as musicians, are, you know, we create a sound. So you have to have a good sound. Hang on, I have to plug in my laptop. Is starting to need a battery. So, yeah. So those are the things that if you do all that stuff, you don't need to worry, you know. I don't need to worry about, you know, am I going to get a gig? Is something going to happen today? I don't know. You have to make stuff happen.
Yeah.
So I always love to make music, so I'm always trying to be creative every day, writing music, playing, practicing, getting better. You know, I haven't stopped getting better, I don't think. Even at 63, I'm still practicing, you know.
Yeah.
Mm. I'm still writing and I'm still trying to find music that I haven't heard before.
Yeah.
You know, being creative in a compositional sense too. And I think, you know, a secure way to have a life in this industry, at least before. I don't know if so much now, because streaming has kind of sucked up a lot of the money out of the music business. Somebody's making money, but it's not always the musicians, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. We're always ripped off, no matter where you go as musicians. It's just par for the course. writing music is essential. You know, making albums, getting your music out there, and making as much music, original music, as possible. Big part of, you know, publishing and writing music and being the writer is essential. And if you can be the artist too, it's much harder being an artist with your own name, you know, because it's easier to be a sideman, to play with other musician bands or be part of a band that's already well-known or well-established. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, you don't have the same security again. This is the stuff you have to weigh up. It's like, you know, a job for Google. You think it's safe, but, you know, the leaders of the bands, I have friends that work with Earth, Wind & Fire. They're not always touring. And the guys, the principals in that band are amazing musicians and have been in the group since the beginning, in the 60s. You know, they don't have to really do much at all, you know, anymore. But the guys in the band go, when are we playing? You know, we need to meet on the road touring. So sideman thing is great. If you can keep going from one group to another group to another group, then it kind of works well. Being the artist and your name is the name on the bill is harder, but ultimately more satisfying. At least it was for me. I made that decision back at GIT when I was a student. I thought, this is great working for all these other people, but I like to write my music. I want to do my music. I made an exception for Chick Corea because I love Chick Corea. But, you know, that gig still gave me time to do my own music and write my own albums and tour with my own bands too, because, you know, he took up about half the year most of the time.
Yeah.
During the Electric Band phase, you know.
So I think we need to talk about the Electric Band for a bit.
Okay.
So you could consider the Electric Band to be an all-star, like an all-star band. You think every one of you are legends in your own style and music. So did you ever, when playing with Chick, did you ever get the feeling of achievement in a way that now we're here, now what?
That's an interesting question. No, it's not about that for me. You know, every career has a cycle, you know, an up and a down. You can't stay on top forever. It's just physically and mentally and logically impossible, you know. People that do, they seem more and more desperate towards the end of their careers. They look, you know, trying to hang on to something. I saw a video of Madonna recently and I went, not looking good, girl. She was singing out of tune. I don't know what the heck's happening, you know. And she's trying to be controversial still. And it just didn't sit well with me, you know. She, in her day, she was all those things. She was beautiful. She was a strong character. She commanded the stage. You know, she wasn't the greatest singer, but boy, did she make up for it in style, and people copied her image, you know. But now she's the same age as me, 63. I don't know. She doesn't need to be controversial anymore. She is who she is. I mean, so I never think of with the Electric Band as something that I never worried about. Oh, look, we're at we're at our peak. It's only downhill from here. No, I never think like that. I loved the whole Electric Band experience. To me, working with the great master that Chick Corea was an honor every time I played with him. I didn't care if there was one person in the audience or 10,000. It's, you know, rubbing shoulders with the master it was like being with Mozart every day. Come on. You know, and playing his music, the challenge of playing that music. A lot of people may think they could play that music, but I tell you, another thing to actually do it, you know. Sometimes I would get his charts, and they were 32 pages long, and I would go, I'll never play this in a million years. My God, it's just crazy. Some stuff I'd never even seen written down before, you know, rhythms and harmony that was, whew, it was deep. And so, you know, to me, it was the experience of being with Chick. And to play that music for big audiences was just ecstatic to me, you know. You know, we took a 10-year break. We sort of went our separate ways in 1992 after a good 7 or 8 year run where the band was playing giant places. And it was incredible fun. And I got to see the world in a way that, you know, most people never would. And then we came back after 10 years and we did the To the Stars record in 2002. And that record is incredible to me. I mean, you know, all those records I'm very proud of being part of. Chick's legacy is one of the things I take the most satisfaction in, because I was a big fan since I was 13. You know, I never thought I'd ever work with him. That was just purely fantasy at my as a young man. So, you know, careful what you wish for, I always say. Because it might just happen. And then when we came back in 2002, the band was very, very strong. I mean, everybody had just matured. And then we toured for a couple of years. And then often we would get together for a couple of weeks here and there throughout the rest of the time. The last show we played all together as the Electric Band was at the Tokyo Jazz Festival in 2019. And that was a huge show, and it was just brilliant. The band was on fire. You know, it truly was an all-star band. I remember going to see the Electric Band when it first started, when it was a trio. And I'll never forget this because I was at the there's a festival in L.A. called the Long Beach Jazz Festival. And the Electric Band record was out, and I was, of course, I bought it. You know, in fact, it was the first CD I ever owned, was the Electric Band record. Wow. And, you know, I already played it to death. I knew all the tunes. So when I went to the show to see them live, I was absolutely knocked out. I'm always knocked out by Chick. And I'm, you know, I had played with Patitucci locally, so I knew John. But I'd never seen Dave before, and Dave was the first guy to hand the front house a stereo mix of his drums. He was the first guy. He's got his own little, you know, as guitar players and bass players and stuff, we have to have our own amps and stuff, and we work on the sounds and everything else. But drummers are in, up to that point, pretty much were at the mercy of the house sound. You know, they put mics on the drums, and, you know, maybe if you got a little reverb on the snare, you were lucky. But Dave... He was triggering stuff. Every drum, you know, was like seven layers of things, you know, and he had beautiful reverbs, and he EQ'd and a mixer and, you know, monitors, and his sound in the house, I'd never heard anything like it. It was mind-boggling, and I thought, wow, this guy, you know, and all of them together, I thought, what a great band, incredible band. I wish they had a guitar player. Again, careful what you wish for, because soon, about a year later, I was in the band.
So it's obviously a technically challenging gig for sure. How did you keep up with the technical demands of the gig? Did you practice like daily? How was your warm-up routine? Did you like take care of your body, especially for those gigs?
You know, preparation is everything with the Electric Band, because we rarely rehearsed. We would rehearse maybe one day before the show, you know, and one rehearsal. So this is something I learned that, you know, you can't just show up and try to read it. Forget about it, you know. You had to come prepared. So I would spend at least a week or two practicing the music on my own. And I find practicing the music on my own is the fastest way for me to get it. You know, it's practicing with the band was good, but that's the end result, you know. Everybody knew their parts. And well, some of the guys were better readers than me, but John sometimes had a few charts on the floor and he'd look down at a few passages that he didn't remember. I was the worst reader in the band, so I had to learn. I had to memorize. I was the first one pretty much to memorize all my parts, and Eric too. But I forgot the question.
So did you have any specific like warm-up routines or preparations like physically for the gig?
No. I think, you know, you just get on the instrument, you start playing and improvising and learning the tunes. You know, with Chick's tunes that were the real hardest, you just take them bar by bar until you get it. And you listen to it 100 times. The famous Chinese proverb, the journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. And that's pretty much how it was with Chick's. You know, you had to catch up to his brain because he would give us demos and the chart, of course. And sometimes I would not even be able to follow it the first couple of times. It was so complex. You know, you're going from 0 to 100 immediately when you get his music. So you have to catch up, you know. So you have to listen to it a lot of times and you go, and then it starts to make sense. And then you can approach it and then you can start to learn it. But I have to listen to it a lot of times first and follow the chart. Because, you know, when it's coming from someone else's brain, it's always harder to get it into your brain because people have their styles, you know. I was very familiar with Chick's style, you know, but even so, all the new music, it took time to learn it. There's no particular warm-up other than just sitting down and putting the time in to learning it. It's like anything else, learning a language or learning any, to master any skill requires due diligence.
Yeah. So do you have any advice? Obviously, we have younger guitar players listening to this when this comes out and trying to pick up your parts from Chick Corea Electric Band catalog and for conservatories or any specific gigs. Do you have any advice how one should approach trying to learn your parts and Chick's music? Any like nuggets of info?
Learning my music too.
Yeah.
catalog of music also. Advice, I think I've already given it. I think, you know, you sit down, you take it a bar at a time when you have to learn a piece of music. You listen to it a lot of times first. And, you know, take the time. Don't hesitate to warm up a little bit. You know, I usually like to just warm up and play first, and then I'll sit down and start listening to what I need to learn. Sometimes if you just, in general, for practice, I think if you spend 15 minutes, if you only have an hour, 15 minutes just deciding what you want to learn, because a lot of times we practice things we already know, and that doesn't move us forward. You need to really to move forward. You have to keep pushing the edge. By that I mean if there's a scale you don't know, or if there's a position you don't know, or if there's a chord you don't understand and you need to know the scale for that chord, you take it and you isolate it and you go, I'm going to learn to play this chord if it's the last thing I do, to improvise on this chord. If it's an altered chord, for example, those are more complex usually. I'm going to take an E7 sharp 9 and I'm going to learn my E super Locrian scale, and I'm just going to have it on a recording just a backing track to make it a little more fun, and just solidly improvise inside this scale for hours. You know, you isolate and you focus on the areas of need, and that will keep you moving forward. So I think that's good advice.
Atte, do you have any questions now?
Yeah, sure. What do you practice on a daily basis?
Well, mostly I practice improvisation.
Yeah.
Because I think that's, if you were to ask me, I would say improvisation is the highest art to achieve on the instrument or any instrument. The art of improvisation is, it's not always appreciated to the level that I think it should be, you know. When scientists have done experiments and they put electrodes on people's brains, the most activity comes from jazz musicians improvising. It's like the 4th of July, it's fireworks going on, all the synapses firing at once because there's so much happening at the same time and spontaneously. Having the skill to weave through chords is an incredible art, and make it sound beautiful and make it artistic and expressive and original. Chick used to have this an expression. Well, I've had discussions with him about improvisation, you know, and he says, you know, the thing about Chick is I used to watch him play every night. Most people didn't get to hear him night after night after night. They would go to one show and they wouldn't hear the next night and the next night and the next night. And it seemed like he was, you could tell it was him, but it was, he had this bottomless resource that he drew from because he was, he never sounded like he repeated anything.
Mm-hmm.
That to me was mind-boggling, and I had to sit down with him once and I said, where are you tapping all this stuff from, this improvisation? You're just are bottomless. And he says, well, the people need to understand the word improvisation means to have no preconceived idea of what you're going to play. Me, I get trapped in my fingers taking me where I've been before, or licks or whatever. Not him. He is a blank slate every time he sits down at the keyboard. And that, to me, is impressive. And I aspire to that every day, is to go where I haven't been before and to try to not repeat myself in improvisation. It's nearly impossible, really hard to do. And to have more control over what you're doing, because I remember recording, there was the album Inside Out we did.
Mm-hmm.
There was one solo, and it became Chick's favorite solo of mine of all the recordings. It was a song called Make a Wish.
Mm-hmm.
Very hard chords. And I did the whole solo. I improvised it. And by a fluke, a miracle, because I had practiced the changes. But on the day when it really counts, when you're recording, it came off really well. I was so happy with the solo. And so was he. He was thrilled. But at the end of the solo, I made a little error. And I said, Chick, can I go back and just fix that? It's really bugging me, that little, I didn't come out right. And he looked at me and he says, I'm not touching it. It's absolutely perfect. I'm not changing a thing. And I said, but I can make it a little better on the end. And he looks at me and says, Frank, if you didn't like it, why did you play it? I had to think about that for a long time. Wow, that's really an impressive thing to say, because why did I play it? You know, that means I'm not really in control too much of what I'm doing. And so that made me really ponder when I play, you know, to really play with a direction and improvising, yes, but be in control of that improvisation as well. So I think that's an interesting story there about improvisation.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Can we talk a bit about your sound? What you crave from your gear? What do you want or need for your guitar and your amp or effects to do? What are the gambale sound? Yeah. What are the key essential parts in terms of gear for you to achieve your sound?
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty simple when it comes to my sound. You know, I don't labor over my sound too much. I have a certain EQ and sustain that I like, and I'm heavy on the low mids. I usually scoop out some mids, and I don't like it to be harsh at all. So 2.5K, I murder that frequency and take it right out. So it, to me, it's like an EQ thing that I'm looking for mostly. Mm-hmm. So in the responsiveness of an amp, you know, I've had lots of amps over the years. I tend to like Marshalls. If I had to choose one amp over everything I've ever had, it's the classic sound of Marshalls. There's something about them that is just correct for distorted guitar and even clean. I play my jazz box through Marshalls. People look at me funny, but, you know, it's not exactly traditional to be playing jazz guitar through a Marshall amp. But, you know, the 412 Celestians are just beautiful. They're my favorite speaker. The Celestians are just perfect sounding to me. Mm-hmm. Now, amps vary. You know, I worked with DV Mark for quite a while, and we developed a beautiful multi-amp FG, which had one of my amp models in it as an amp modeling amp. Right now I'm using, on this tour, I'm going to use a Laney head. I've been talking to the Laney guys. It's called an Iron Heart. And I'm going to use that through Marshall speaker. And some pedals. I'm going to try something different this time, you know, just use floor pedals. I really usually don't use floor pedals. I usually like the amp to rack mount effects better. But I'm going to explore my setup for this time. I haven't actually solidly decided what I'm using yet. And I'm only 2 weeks away, so I better get cracking. it'll sound good. I'm pretty sure. The Laney sounds awesome. I'm really, really loving the tone. Going back to tube a little bit, it's got one tube in there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just it sounds delightful to me. So I'm going to play really well because my sound will be good.
And obviously in your picking style and sweep picking, the pick is really important. And are you still using a bigger, like a triangle type pick? Yeah.
Yes.
That's right.
Using the same pick for almost 40 years. So yeah. I'm not likely to change it anytime soon. This tip, the reason I use these, it works better for sweep because the tip, although it's got a point, it's a lot softer curve than a standard teardrop pick. And I love that all sides are the same. So you get three picks for the price of one, which is good value. And so it doesn't matter which side you're on. It just, you can keep going, you know. Now, these are a plastic or whatever they are, plastic, I think. Yeah, and they're 1 millimeter, you know, regular heavy pick. And this is softer, so it glides over the strings a little better for sweeping. And it's been true for all those years. I haven't changed the pick because I haven't found one that I like more than these.
Yeah.
So they work. They work for me. And actually, when I've given them to other guys to try, they go, you know, this is pretty cool. It works. And I like the size of this for a reason. When I hold the pick, this pick, I don't know if you can get the angle. Yeah. It sits right in the crook of my hand, so it gives it this real solid, it can't move.
Yeah.
It doesn't move. Yeah. it's a really smaller picks, you know, you're kind of holding it like that, and it's not the same. So it's these little subtle things that, for me, make it more comfortable to play. I don't want to think about the pick, you know.
Yeah.
I just want to play. The string height has to be right. Everything has to be just right. If you want to play your best, you can't be distracted ever by anything. Yeah. You know, if the sound isn't right, you're distracted. If the string height's too high, you're struggling to play. If the pick isn't right, you know, there's a lot of things that can distract you.
Yeah.
The girls in the second row can distract you. you know. So there's all kinds of things that can take you off your concentration. And it's really, so I try to minimize any of that. You know, stupid drum beats that are not the right beat, you know, that can distract me really bad. Yeah. So, you know, there's all kinds of things. So having good concentration is really the way to play the best. So you get into the zone and nothing's distracting. It's pure concentration.
Yeah. Controlling the things you can control.
Well, yes, exactly. That you can control. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Well, that's, you just want the conditions to be right. You know, sometimes the hall, depending on the room, you know, there's all these acoustic considerations too. You know, some rooms sound great. Some stages sound great. Others sound wrong. And you just scratch your head as to why sometimes. But there can be too much glass or it's, you know, the shape of the room, you know. We all have our favorite clubs. I've played probably every club on the planet. So I know which ones I like and which ones I don't. Some of these are actually new venues on this trip. So I'm looking forward to getting around Europe, and I haven't been to Finland forever. So I'm really looking forward to being there too.
Yeah, great. We're waiting for you too.
Yeah.
I presume you're coming to the show. Which one are you going to, the Espoo one or the...
The Espoo one.
Yeah. The Pori. Espoo. Is that how it's pronounced?
Yeah,
right.
Espoo doesn't sound good. Espoo. Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I'll leave one of the O's off then.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it sounds like.
Great. Yep.
Excellent.
Yeah. So, like, ending this discussion and interview with, do you have any plans for the future or any dreams that you have yet to fulfill?
Yes. I want to play the main stage in Montreux and North Sea and Montreal Jazz Festivals with my music, my band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But three. So make it happen, universe! So those are three things on my bucket list for sure.
Yeah. That sounds good.
Yeah. Okay, guys, thanks for the interview. Yes. Appreciate it. I'm looking forward to being there, and we'll see you when I get to Finland.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Thank you. It's been
all the best.
Honor and privilege to have you in our show. Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Let me know when it's broadcast. I can forward it onto my social media too.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Kuuntelet Kitarapodia.